Does anyone here besides me occasionally listen to podcasts? There are several that I like to listen to, usually when I'm driving. One that I enjoy, for example, is called Everything Happens and features Dr. Kate Bowler, who is an associate professor of American religious history at Duke Divinity School and happens to be the author of the book Good Enough that the Tuesday morning group just read and discussed during Lent. She's also the author of a book which is the provides the title of the podcast. Her book is called Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. I also like listening to a podcast called Enneagram 2.0, in which the two teachers, who are considered two top teachers of this ancient personal development and transformation system, which is the Enneagram, share current teachings and new insights. And I will admit that from time to time, I also enjoy a show called Crime Junkie, in which the hosts, Ashley Flowers and Britt, report on true crime cases, some that have been solved, some that have not. Within the last few days, I have learned about a new podcast, one that just premiered on April 11th, very recently. So far has only released 3 episodes, and it's called Wiser Than Me, and is hosted, you may recognize the host, by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who you may know. Maybe I'm confessing something here too, but she played Elaine on the sitcom Seinfeld. In this podcast, Julia, who is now 62, interviews women who are older than she is, and in her opinion, wiser than she is, hence the name, Wiser Than Me. She talks with them about work, family, relationships, love, aging, and more. She talks with them about what they've experienced over the course of their lives and what they've learned. She talks with them about life and what matters and what makes it meaningful. I have found it in the 2 episodes that I've listened to be fascinating and super fun. In the trailer for the show, Julia talks about how in our culture, that, as we all know, focuses so heavily on youth and puts such a high value on being and looking and acting young, that older women are easily dismissed and made invisible. She goes on to share that as she gets older herself, she wants to make these women more visible. She wants to learn from them. She wants to take in some of the considerable wisdom that they have gleaned from their lives. And I, for one, am grateful that she's having these conversations. I've listened to conversations with, you may guess this one right away, the first one was Jane Fonda, who is 85, she proudly says, and Isabel Allende, the other one. I'm happy that she's having these conversations in a way that allows me to eavesdrop on them, because I agree with her that there is tremendous and often unacknowledged wisdom within the elders among us. On Easter Sunday, if you were here, you heard me talk about how we tend to not see what we're not looking for. I didn't have a chance to talk with anyone about the gorilla experiment. If any of you had seen that before, or if you hadn't, if you saw the gorilla, I'd be curious to hear your responses to that now, 2 weeks later. Perhaps Julia Louis-Dreyfus would say that this is another example of that, the idea that in our culture we tend not to see the wisdom that our older folks, and particularly women, I think, have to offer, in large part because we are blinded by the screaming desire that seems to exist in our culture for all things young. And therefore, we tend to not see much of the value, much value in things that are old, or at least not young. As often may happen in my sermons, you may be sitting here wondering, what in the heck does this have to do with Jesus and the road to Emmaus? Well, it seems to me that today's gospel passage is yet another example of not seeing what we're not looking for. I don't have the scripture printed out this morning, but I wonder if someone here would be willing to open a Bible to that passage and read just the first few verses. Is there a volunteer? Jennifer Holmes, just read, please, verses 13 through 16. And if you, Jennifer, are you willing to do it at the mic there next to you? 13 through 16, chapter 24, sorry, Luke chapter 24, 13 through 16, please. Thank you.
13 through 24?
Through 16, just 16. Those, just okay. The first few.
Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other and about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked with them, but they were kept from recognizing him.
Thank you. So these two people, some of the commentaries I read suggested maybe it was a man and a woman. Maybe it was Cleopas and his wife. I was about to say two men, but these two people were disciples of Jesus. They were heading away from Jerusalem, where, of course, Jesus had just been crucified a few days before. They were leaving town, getting out of Dodge, heading to a nearby village called Emmaus. And as they went, it says they were talking with each other about all these things that had happened, all the things they shared a few minutes later when this stranger came up, alongside them and started walking with them. And this stranger asked them, "What are you talking about?" The stranger that we are told was Jesus himself. But they, we are also told, don't recognize him. They do not recognize him. They are his disciples. Presumably, then, they knew him fairly well. They had spent at least some time with him. Not to mention, they were just talking about him, but they're not looking for him in those moments, and they don't see him. They're not expecting to see him in that place, and they don't. Luke says their eyes were kept from recognizing him. Was there something covering their eyes, like a blindfold? Is that what kept them from recognizing him? I'm pretty sure that's not the case. Was something covering Jesus' face, like a mask? Or like the masks that we wear and we don't really recognize each other sometimes. Sometimes we don't recognize each other without our masks now. I don't think Jesus was wearing a mask. So what kept them from recognizing him? Maybe it was their grief, their sadness. People who have experienced deep grief, people who have known profound sadness, will tell you that that degree of pain can cloud your thinking. That depth of suffering can and does muddle your mind. And so the deep grief and sadness that those disciples were likely experiencing certainly could have affected their ability to see what, or in this case, who, was right there in front of them. Their capacity to recognize Jesus might also have been compromised by the despair that they were feeling. They're described as looking sad in the NRSV, or in other translations, downcast or brokenhearted even. Or in the Message, it says they were long-faced, like they had lost their best friend. Other words that come to my mind to describe how they might have been feeling are dejected and hopeless. And you can hear it, I think, as they talk to this stranger who is Jesus and tell him about who Jesus was and how he had been betrayed and then killed. And then they say, "We had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel." You can hear both their longing in that and their despair. "We had hoped he was the one." We had so hoped. Our people have been waiting for so long, for years, for centuries. We had hoped he was the one. It really seemed like he was the one, but he wasn't. I guess we know now that he wasn't. He wasn't who we thought he was. He wasn't who we so desperately wanted him to be. He wasn't who we so desperately hoped he was. And that hope now is gone, crushed. It's not just Jesus who's dead. It's our hope that's also dead. The disciples were not only discouraged, they were dejected. And that could easily have kept them from seeing clearly. They were not only disheartened, they were despairing. And that could absolutely have kept their eyes from recognizing Jesus. And yet, the hope that they had been longing for was standing right there next to them. The promises of forgiveness and new life and healing and belonging that they had clung to for centuries were embodied again and walking alongside them. The victory of life and love that they had desperately desired was right there in their midst. And in those moments, they couldn't see any of it. In those moments, their eyes were kept from recognizing him because they were focused on something else. Their hearts were turned in a different direction. They'd been expecting a specific result. They'd been hoping for a particular outcome, and their eyes were kept from recognizing him. So what keeps us from recognizing God in our midst? The reality of God and God's longing for a relationship with us, God's whisper of belovedness to us, God's invitation to wholeness for us, God's challenge to justice among us. All of that is right here in our midst, right now. And most, if not all of us, don't always, and maybe not even often, recognize it. Like those two disciples, maybe it's our grief that keeps us from recognizing it, or our confusion, or maybe our anger, or our shame, or our fear. I think that's a big one. We fear so many things. Maybe it's our feelings of unworthiness. Maybe it's our feelings of self-righteousness. Maybe it's our feelings of indifference and the mind-muddling effect that any of those emotions can have when they become all-consuming. What is it that keeps us, like the disciples, from recognizing the reality of the risen Christ as we walk along our paths and live our lives, our daily lives, our everyday living? Because Christ is no less risen today than he was that day. No less resurrected now than he was then. And like those disciples, our eyes often seem to be kept from seeing him. Perhaps by the despair that we feel at the events going on in the world around us. Perhaps by discouragement that we feel at situations in our own lives. Maybe sometimes we feel hopeless about the things that are happening around us. And that hopelessness turns our heart away in a different direction. Maybe sometimes we're hoping for a particular outcome in a particular situation, one that makes sense to us, one that looks like what we've been expecting, one that looks like what we are hoping for. And those hopes and expectations draw our focus away from the hope that we can find in the risen Christ, in God's ultimate victory of light over darkness and life over death and love over all. What are the things that keep our eyes from recognizing what is holy and sacred that is all around us? Because it is all around us all the time. mystery and beauty and majesty and abundance and wholeness and love, all of that and more, all that is sacred, is all around us, infusing our lives and life itself. I wonder if we're kept from recognizing it by our expectations that we'll see all of that in certain ways, through particular experiences, in specific contexts, with people that we've deemed appropriate and acceptable. What are the things that keep our eyes from recognizing the risen Christ in our midst, that keep us from seeing signs of hope and newness of life, that keep us from perceiving what is sacred and holy and beautiful and true and just and good? What are the things that keep our hearts from seeing God and the reality of God in our lives and in the world? Because the reality of God is all around us. What is holy and sacred and beautiful and true and just and good is all around us. Hope and newness of life is all around us. The risen Christ is in our midst. May God open our eyes and our hearts to see it. Amen.